future.
Good morning and welcome to True Talk. This is your host Sama Jarrah. Stay tuned and enjoy this music. It's called Talad at Three Knocks of the Heart.
الشمس واقف عالبحر بعيد عمال بحكيله واشكيله واشرح واعيد فجأة لقيتها وكنت فاكرها عروسة البحر خارجة من المية وطلتها اقوى من السحر لما شفتها قلبي دق تلات دقات والطبلة بلعبت جوا دماغي حاجات لما دخل قلبي رق وحيد
Welcome back to True Talk. This is your host, Sama Jarrah. The song is Egyptian, and the guy's name is Abu, like the father of Abu. I'm not sure the father of who. And it says three beats of the heart. So obviously the track was missing a few beats when we were playing it. At least this is how it sounded to me. I want to thank all our listeners and the WMNF community that contributed during the fund drive. We had to do 2 days of fund driving, and I think we managed to get whatever goal we were supposed to get. But and I think WMNF also reached its goal. But you can always give money. I had today somebody from Saudi Arabia actually told me that they tried to give money, but they were directed to another website, and they were afraid that they might be giving to the wrong radio station. I had several people from all over the States telling me, because I post these things on Facebook/TrueTalk, and they wanted to send money. So some of them are going to send money, and some of them said they will do it at the next time. So thank you, everybody who keeps TrueTalk on the air, and thank you for supporting WMNF. As you know, I always say this, but Ahmed and I don't get paid to do this show. We do it because we believe in the mission statement of WMNF and the freedom of speech and the right for you to listen to different voices. In my case, I am a woman and Muslim and Palestinian, and was born in Kuwait and lived in Kuwait and Jordan and Lebanon and Saudi Arabia and where else? Can't remember. Egypt. Oh gosh, I lived there for 9 years. And then, of course, I have been here almost 30 years. My gosh, almost 30 years. Half of them at WMNF. So thank you for supporting us. I'm going to give you maybe another song. Try another song. It's from Morocco, but an Egyptian is singing it. And it's the Berber language. It's not Arabic. The one you were listening to was Arabic. This one is not, because I'm going to take a break and call Dawood Walid. You all know that it's the Black Month now, and he's an African-American, but he will talk from a Muslim perspective. So let me play. This is Hamza Nimra, and this is True Talk, and I'm going to be right back. Back to True Talk. As I mentioned, I'm going to be talking to Brother Dawood Walid. He is currently the executive director of the Michigan chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, but he is also an author and activist, and he is a teacher of Islam and racial justice proponent, and he is on Twitter, for those of you who follow Twitter. And if you go to his Twitter handler, it's Dawood Walid, Dawood the name, D-A-W-U-D, and last name W-A-L-I-D. It's full of interesting input, Brother Dawood, when it comes about African-American, celebrating African-American heritage. When I read your feed, it's celebrating African-American heritage from also the Muslim perspective, something that is not often mentioned when people talk about the legacy of African Americans in the U.S. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Most definitely, and thank you for having me coming on. What escapes the minds of many people in the United States of America is that African Americans not only helped build this country, but that there have been Muslims of African descent who came to America and have been here longer than there was the United States of America. It's estimated that about up to 30% of the enslaved Africans that were brought from West Africa to the shores of the United States of America were Muslim. And there is historical evidence that not only did these Muslims come from various West African tribes, but there were some who actually were called, are known as Shurafa, who were descendants of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. They were highly literate scholars, memorized the Quran. And there are a number of biographies, or what some people call slave narratives, that were written by enslaved Africans who were Muslims, who wrote about their experiences in the Arabic language, and those can be found.
Can you tell us names? Are there books, for instance, that can explain all that you are talking about?
Well, one that does so in the most concise way is a historian who is based in New York at the Schomburg Center. Her name is Sylviane Jouf, but it's a Wolof name, so it starts with a D, D-I-O-U-F, and she wrote a book called Servants of Allah, African Muslims Enslaved in the Americas, and it gives very thorough proof from historical sources, also from anthropological sources, detailing the African Muslims who were enslaved in the Americas, given their background, but not just here, but going down to the Caribbean as well as in Brazil, and also chronicles how there were Muslims of African descent who were leaders in many of the slave rebellions that took place in the Americas.
Why is it important to mention that and to write about it? Because you always write about it, but also there are other brothers and sisters out there who, you know, they don't get as much retweets and as much likes, as much coverage when they write about the Muslim African narrative and history in this nation. It seems that other even African Americans are not paying attention to our part in this, the Muslim part.
Well, I think part of it is that we Muslims haven't done as good of a job in propagating the information as we could, and especially Muslims of African descent. After the martyrdom of the assassination of Malcolm X, in which he was assassinated on February 21st, 53 years ago, when many Muslims who were black left the nation and came into normative Islam, or some would say Sunni Islam, in the sake of trying to look universal and not look nationalist, that many Muslims of African descent actually gave up talking about the contributions of Muslims of African descent in America, didn't write about those things, and even became more, we could say, Arab-centric or South Asian-centric, and to the point of not even writing about or talking about our own history and sojourn, and this left a gap where even works about Malcolm X, you'll see that the predominant works about Malcolm X in the United States of America or writings are written by people who are Pan-Africanist or Marxist-leaning. They are not people who have written books or writing about Malcolm X from an Islamic perspective. So this is, I don't blame people who are even African-American who aren't Muslim for centering this narrative. I put more of the onus on Muslims of African-American descent, in particular us not doing our due diligence in lifting up this narrative.
I want to go back to Malcolm X, but before that, Dawood, I want to go to the people who were enslaved. I mean, they were not slaves in Africa, but they were enslaved here in America. Were they able to maintain the religion? I mean, you know about the noble ones or the scholars, and I think you have co-written a book, if I'm not mistaken, and it's called Centering Black Narrative, Black Muslim Nobles Among the Early Pious Muslims. But the other ones, the not maybe as educated and as literate as those pious people, were they able to maintain the religion, or they converted, or they forgot about it? Because it's very important for our listeners to know that to understand or to be able to do Salah, the prayer, the five prayers of the day, and to read the Quran, you need the Arabic language. And most of these people who came, their first language was not Arabic. If they were Muslim, they must have had some Islamic teaching, and Arabic is not their major language. So it's easy to lose it, Dawood, don't you think that's correct?
Well, there's historical proof that West African Muslims spoke and knew several languages, were highly literate, and not just the scholars, but in general, that Muslims came from a civilization of literacy. And of course, we know about Sankora University and Timbuktu and the scholarship that came. But Muslims were actually, the Muslim slaves on average were more literate than their European slave masters. But there were struggles for Muslims to keep their Islam alive. And when I'm saying this, I'm including the Arabic language as well, as many of them being highly literate in Arabic, though they were not Arabs. But there was a systematic means of taking Muslims away from Islam. So when people talk about Islamophobia in America, it started way before 9/11. It started way before the Iranian Revolution or even the Asian Exclusion Act of 1924. There were laws on books and colonies in areas where people cannot practice other religions, or the slaves, enslaved people cannot practice anything other than Christianity. There was a systematic means of trying to disconnect children from knowledge, not just of their tribal affiliation and languages, but also religion. And how that was done is that when children were born, it was very frequently happened that children would be born and then would be sold off to other plantations. So the effect that that would do is that would disconnect the transmission of knowledge from the father or the father and the mother to the Muslim child, and then they would be Christianized by their basically 100% European slave masters who were Christians.
If you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF, and I'm talking to Dawood Waleed, who is African-American and a teacher of Islam and racial justice proponent, and he is also the author or co-author of a book called Centering Black Narrative, Black Muslims Nobles Among the Early Pious Muslims Who Came to America. Let me go back to Malcolm X. Malcolm X was not born a Muslim, and I think, Dawood, you were not born Muslim yourself. But let me talk about the importance of Malcolm X, and maybe our listeners are not very familiar, especially the younger generation, with the Nation of Islam, and how Malcolm became Muslim, and then the rift that happened between the two groups.
Okay, well, Malcolm X, born Malcolm Little, came from a highly educated family. His father and mother both were leaders in the United Negro Improvement Association. It was a black nationalist organization started by the Honorable Marcus Garvey. And so he, from a very young age, was acculturated and given a worldview that was greater than just a Eurocentric-only worldview. His father was killed in Michigan by the Ku Klux Klan, and he ended up becoming a wayward child and ended up being in prison. While in prison, two of his brothers introduced to him the Nation of Islam, a proto-Islamic movement that they had joined in the city of Detroit, and through their convincing and also communications in letter form with Elijah Muhammad, who at that time was the leader of the Nation of Islam, Malcolm X embraced the Nation of Islam doctrine and theology. And when he got out of prison, he then came and settled in the Detroit area, and the first place that he spoke at was known as Temple Number One in Detroit. The Nation of Islam started here. off of a street called Linwood and Burlingame. It's off of Linwood and Burlingame. It's now called Masjid Wali Muhammad. It's now a Sunni Muslim mosque, and I'm actually scheduled to give the Friday sermon at this mosque today. But this is the first place that Malcolm X came to, and the first place that he preached at, and his popularity came from started from this location, which I'm speaking at today.
Wow. Is the Nation of Islam now more mainstream than it used to be during the Elijah Muhammad?
Some of their rhetoric has toned down, and they have made some adjustments, like fasting the month of Ramadan according mm-hmm. to the lunar calendar instead of fasting the month of December, because they used to fast just the month of December. There have been some small adjustments, but for the most part, the theology of the Nation of Islam, mainstream Muslim Sunnis and Shias would consider their theology to be heterodox, not orthodox, in the sense that they believe that God came in the person of a man into the city of Detroit in 1930. This is a heterodox belief, and they still believe that Elijah Muhammad was a messenger of God. However, mainstream Muslims or those in orthodoxy believe that the last messenger of a God was Muhammad ibn Abdullah 14 centuries ago, who was from Quraysh and was an Arab. So these two major points, the Nation of Islam today, under the leadership of Mr. Louis Farrakhan, they still hold on to these beliefs that are considered heterodox.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Dawood, because some people assume that there is only one Islam, but there are, even within the Sunni Islam, the majority of Muslims are Sunni. There are many different schools of thought, and then we have the Shia, we have many schools, and then we have the Ismailiyya, we have so many different, and then there is the Islam in America, or the, African-American Muslims who can be from any of the ones that I mentioned, or be part of the Nation of Islam. So if anybody is interested in asking Dawood Waleed, you can send us an email to dj@wmnf.org, dj@wmnf.org. Maybe we can take a few phone calls. Waleed will stay with us another couple of minutes. 813-239-9663. 813-239-9663. I think this is the number that we have these days. I want, if you don't mind, tell me about your journey to Islam, because you were not born a Muslim, Dawood.
Well, my journey to Islam was, everyone has their own story, their own way in which they came, but my father actually was, is from Detroit, and he actually used to attend the Nation of Islam mosque starting as a teenager. He used to go there. My mother is a Baptist, and she comes from the South, from Virginia. So I was born. My mother and father got divorced when I was very young, and I went with my mom to Virginia. And from there, I was sent to Sunday school. I went to church. I didn't have any contact with Muslims until I became a teenager. And I basically distanced myself from Christianity about the age of 15. Some of the theological things didn't make sense. But also, this was around the time of conscious hip-hop music began to rise up when I was a teen in the late 80s. And it was really hip-hop music that was my gateway to reading the autobiography of Malcolm X. And once I read that, I read it maybe about 2 or 3 years, even before the movie about Malcolm X came up, the Spike Lee movie. After that, in like 1990, 91, I read a book about the history of Prophet Muhammad, prayers and peace be upon him. And from reading about Prophet Muhammad, I embrace Islam as my truth, and that was coming close almost like on 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So. But were you in the army also? Did you serve in the U.S.
Yeah,
Army?
Was it before you became... No, I was a Muslim when I served in the U.S. Navy from 1994 to 1998. So yeah, I'd already been Muslim when I went and served in the U.S. Navy. And in my training school, in my boot camp, there was one other Muslim who was an immigrant from Iran. I went to training school. There was an Iraqi Muslim brother in my training school. And then in my unit, there was only myself and one other Muslim. And there wasn't many of us, and it was very difficult. I did face some Islamophobia while I was in the U.S. military. And mind you, this is years before 9/11. But we did face some Islamophobia in the U.S. military.
Wow. So you have double jeopardy. I always read about some of the sisters' accounts, especially the ones who wear the hijab, who are African American, born in the USA, have no connection whatsoever to the Arab world, have never even set foot in the Arab world. Maybe they haven't even eaten Arabic food. And they say they face double jeopardy because they are black. And then they are, it's very obvious that they are Muslim and wearing the hijab. Do you feel the same, that, you know, you're suffering from two blows coming to your way when it comes to discrimination? Or
Yeah, I do. Feel
like the women are different, maybe.
I do feel like I suffer two blows, but it's much more overt for Muslim women who are African American who wear hijab. Because if I'm walking around the city of Detroit, Detroit is an 80% African-American city. I mean, there are people who recognize me from television in our city, but if I'm walking around, I blend in just like any African-American who could be Hebrew Israelite or Baptist or Methodist. No one knows what my religion is. But then, you know, Detroit is a very Muslim-friendly city inside the actual inner city to begin with, for historical reasons. But for a Muslim woman who's especially traveling in the suburban areas in this area, and being black, I know for sure that it's not an easy situation. But on a personal level, I feel more consternation, I feel more apprehension about being profiled or mistreated because of my racial identity and not because of my religious identity.
If you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF, and we're talking to Dawood Waleed, who is a teacher of Islam, a writer, a lecturer. You give sermons, Friday sermons, as an imam, and I know that you have learned Arabic, and your Arabic, the written Arabic, is excellent, and I think also your classical spoken Arabic. When I went to your blog, Dawood, I noticed that you have been to Senegal, and you are trying to connect to your past with Africa? Can you tell us a little bit about your trip to Senegal? I've never been there.
Well, I've been to Mali, Senegal. I just got back 4 days ago from Ghana. I was in Ghana for 2 weeks. Oh. I spoke at a couple of conferences there and did some media appearances there. My extensions to West Africa, there's twofold reason. One is that my teachers in the Islamic studies have been from, I've had some West African teachers that I study underneath. So I have a connection back to the ulama, to the scholars of West Africa, many of them who are just trained there, but some of them who are graduates of the prestigious Al Azhar University in Cairo, Egypt. So that's one connection. But then there is also the connection of ancestral roots and ties to West Africa. So I visited the infamous El Mina slave castle in Ghana, it's off the Cape Coast. And this was the first slave castle that was built to transport Africans to the Americas. It was started by the Portuguese and taken over by the Dutch, and then later by the British. It operated in shipping Africans for about 400 years to the Americas. Then I've also, gone to Gori Island in Senegal. It's off the coast of Dakar, which is the capital. I will say that, just to give a little taste of it being like a spiritual experience as well. I had a different feeling in Gori Island in Senegal than I did in Ghana and at the slave castles. Both of them have locations that they call the Door of No Return. Oh. And it was believed that when an African went through that door, that they or their children would never make it back to America. Thus, the Europeans called it the Door of No Return. And I had like a very spiritual experience when I went, and it was almost felt like I had been there before. But I was with a group of people, and we were, you know, getting emotional here, you know, seeing the slave dungeons, hearing about the women in Senegal, Gambia area. Is you know, there were no Christians in that area. They were all Muslims. Christianity didn't reach that area until colonialism. So, you know, I knew that this was an area where my Muslim mothers and aunties were being raped. They had special quarters there just for raping women. So we got emotional. So the tour guide, who's Senegalese, he spoke English. He looked over at me and he said, "You know, the Europeans called this the Door of No Return, and they believed that you would never make it back." But then he looked at me, and he said, "Alhamdulillah, I mean, praise God." He said, "You've made it back." He said, "The children of Islam, they've returned home." And when he told me that, he came and hugged me, and I bawled like a baby.
Wow, you're giving me goosebumps here, Waleed. This is amazing. My gosh. Oh. So how many people take this trip?
These are popular tourist destinations for African-Americans, both to Ghana and to Senegal. I know, I haven't seen recent data, but I know about a decade ago that Ghana was the number one international tourism destination for African-Americans in Detroit. So I'm not sure about other places, but mm-hmm. while I was there just recently, I ran into African Americans from different areas, from Atlanta, Georgia in particular. I ran into quite a few at the airport, New York City as well. So they were there to, you know, connect back with the people. Some of them have economic interests. In the capital of Ghana, there is an expat community where basically there is approximately 10,000 African Americans who live there and have basically said they've gotten tired of living in America. They don't want to live in America anymore. They're tired of discrimination, and they've moved back to Africa, and they live in the capital. And while I was there, I had on several occasions, I had people tell me, you know, "Why don't you move back home," meaning back to Ghana. Mm-hmm. And they were saying, you know, "You're not going to face any of this discrimination here. You can come help your people here. You don't have to worry about Trump and all that stuff." You know, so I heard it multiple times. Also, they cannot stand Donald Trump in West Africa. I mean, the Muslim ban's one reason. The other reason is he called their country's, you know, profanity.
Yeah.
So, you know, actually something else I will mention before I be quiet is that what's popped up in West Africa now are centers of people trying to get citizenship or visas to Canada. It used to be that the people wanted to come to America, but now the people there don't want to come to America, not for tourism or even to get student or work visas. They want to go study or go work in Canada. So it's going to be a long-term there's going to be long-term negative economic effects for our country when all of these immigrants don't want to come to America anymore. And immigrants contribute greatly to our country, but they're not going to want to come because Trump is doing all these anti-immigrant things and talking about making America great again, which means making America white again. And the people there, they just don't want to be bothered with America.
That's what the African-American community feel that with this slogan, "Making America Again," because, you know, I've been living in America 30 years. I've never noticed America wasn't great in the past 6 years or 10 or 15. I mean, we still have the same problems. Actually, they are getting worse with these killings in the schools and the wars. I mean, nothing is changing to me or changed, except we have more more technology. But this is how African Americans in general see this slogan, Make America Again, Great Again.
Oh, yeah. It's very evident to African Americans in general, it's code language. If when they say take our country back, like they said with Barack Obama, and Trump popularized that too when he was leading the birther movement, take our country back, make America great again, is take our country back from white domination, which our country still dominated. Fortune 500 companies and upper echelon of government, military, industrial complex, it's still dominated by white people. Hollywood is dominated by white people, but these are code words to make sure the hegemony and the slight gains that people of color have made, be they black, Latino, Arab, we don't want them to have anything. And African Americans know, all the ones I know in my family and otherwise friends, when we heard that language, we know what this code language means.
I want to thank you, Brother Dawood Waleed, for being on True Talk. What's your khutbah today? You're giving a sermon today. What is it going to be about?
The sermon today, God willing, will be based upon a verse of the Quran that says, let there be among you a group that calls towards goodness and enjoins the good and forbids the evil. And those who do this will be the muflihun. They will be the successful people. So this is the three steps towards organizing ourselves to have successful community life. So, calling towards good, and enjoying the mahruf, the goodness and the justice, and forbidding the bad things and the injustice, and those people who do those three things and organize themselves around these three, they will be successful in any society they live in.
I have a quick question from somebody on Twitter. What can American Muslims do in these days? Very cool, like in 2 minutes, if you can, or one.
What American Muslims can do primarily, and number one, is be sincere, right? That we do not need to have a what I call a performative Islam. We practice our Islam and be good citizens, but we do it for goodness sake. We don't perform Islam in a way that we are trying to impress other people, that we are trying to curry and win other people's favor or their acceptance. That's not what we should be looking for. And too much of our socio-political engagement has been around photo ops or instead of educating people and calling people to what we believe in, we're too busy seeking behind their acceptance. I think this is one of the biggest things that Muslims need to deal with and the biggest challenges that we face as a community. The second thing is we need to be educated about our religion and not just in the internet or YouTube, that we need to really sit and take the time of learning the difference under qualified teachers between what is Islam and what is culture, right? Or what we have learned that is necessary, what is those things that are recommended, and then those things that simply beautify the life but are not necessarily mandatory. Like, Muslims need to know the difference, right? And I think these are two very important things.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Dawood, because it is so much needed, especially the new generation here that needs really to learn about the religion, what it says in the Quran, but not what's the internet says. I want to thank you, Dawood Waleed, for being on True Talk.
Thank you very much. Take care, husband.
That was Dawood Waleed. He has an interesting book. I have to read it, honestly. I have read about it, but I have to order it. So next time when I bring him, I am more aware of what's the content. But he mentioned it's the title, Centering Black Narrative, Black Muslims Nobles Among the Early Pious Muslims. Many of the people who were brought from Africa to America as slaves were learned people. Let's try and listen to Hamza Numera, Egyptian, singing Moroccan song, but in Berber language. Very confusing, but you will enjoy it. I'm going to try and get the CPAC segment where they talk about Islam. Oh my gosh. This is True Talk on WMNF, and we'll open the phone lines 813-239-9663. If any of you saw that yesterday, you're more than welcome to call, or to maybe we're going to be talking about guns from my perspective. Okay, listen to this music. Welcome back to True Talk. I'm still trying to find the segment I'm talking about. I listened to some parts of it yesterday, and it was, I think, moderated by somebody they imported from England, Rahim Qassam, who is a former Muslim, but very active being against Islam and Muslims. And John Bolton and Zuhdi Jasser, they were talking about Islam and what should be done about Islam. And also there was this French lady who was trying to warn America that Muslims are taking over. We're not even, what? I mean, there is confusion about the number of Muslims in America. Some people say we are only 2 million. And some people say we are 7 million. And you have seen from, or have heard from my conversation with Dawood Waleed, that even if we were 7 million Muslims in America, we all come from different backgrounds and different type of religiosity and different type of, I don't want to say Islam, but different schools of thought. So for instance, you have a huge, large number of Muslims in America who are African American, and some of them a great number of them are from the Nation of Islam, who think there is another prophet other than Muhammad alayhi salatu wassalam, where all Muslims believe is the final prophet. No, they believe that there is another prophet that came to America, and it's Elijah Muhammad. So, you know, even if we were large in number, but we are not all one color, one ethnicity, one thought. There are many Muslims who are Republican, many Muslims who support Trump. There are many Muslims who support Bernie Sanders, many Muslims who were Democrat and supported Hillary, and many Muslims were independent. And many Muslims didn't care either way because they just don't care. So it's interesting that in this CPAC that is going on, they have had to bring people from Europe and to talk about Islam and Muslims. And, you know, if I can't find it now, I'll tell you about it. For instance, they have this American Muslim by the name of Zuhdi Jasser who was speaking. And, you know, they were talking about the threats that threaten America. And there was concentration, of course, on Iran. And then he says, no, we need to shift the conversation. We have to say it's about Muslims, blah, 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 blah. And he says, I am of Syrian, you know, I come from Syrian descent and my parents, and he is lying when he said that, because both his parents were Palestinian from Palestine. But I think he thought, you know, if I say I'm Palestinian among all these people, maybe they will not like it. So he said, I'm Syrian. So he even fakes his own, I can't believe I used this word, but he does not tell the truth about his parents. If you're so ashamed of your parents being Palestinian, why on earth are you bothering to be in CPAC to talk about it? So it's interesting. The other interesting thing that happened to me in the past week or less, I'm sorry, I keep taking my, I have a cold. Is, of course, the idea of the weapons. People in the Arab world, and maybe if my brother wants to join the conversation, because he gets all these questions. I mean, both him and I are getting these questions, and some of them, of course, I know how to answer. But what kind of questions are they asking, Ali? Ali is in the studio with me. Thank God he was driving today because I don't feel very good.
Well, the first question I receive, and it's always the same question, is like, why are all the shootings in schools? I mean,
yeah, it's like, we don't want to give ideas to people to shoot elsewhere, but
no, but I mean, why? I mean, I only hear about shootings, and everybody hears about shootings in schools. They don't hear about it somewhere else. I mean, God forbid, we don't want them anywhere, even in schools. So, but why just in schools?
I don't know, Ali.
And there's another question.
What?
Okay, we don't live in a war zone here in the U.S. And I live here. I don't feel afraid from anyone, that I need to protect myself. Why do I need to own a gun?
Okay, this is a huge debate here in America and has to do with the Second Amendment, where it is by law we are allowed to carry guns. But, you have to think, Ali, that when they built this country or when they wrote the Constitution, it was many years ago, and people needed protection, and there were
still... Yeah, but I mean, as a new immigrant here to the country, and I'm a male... Middle age, dark skinned,
but blue eyes. Exposes the fact that you might be
still
a fake Arab.
But I'm labeled, so, and I don't feel afraid.
No, but when you walk in the seat, there is nobody who would say.
Yeah, so why do I need to own a gun? I mean, legally, I can own a gun today, but I never thought of it.
I don't know, our listeners who own guns, maybe they can... there isn't a law that says you can't own a gun, but I think many of the questions I got, why on earth a 17 years old can buy a gun?
Cigarettes now, right? I don't smoke. I don't need to smoke. So it's the same thing. I mean, I can go buy guns, but do I need them? Do I need to buy guns to protect myself from what? Like, when you're walking
in the street... Some people use it for sport.
That's something else. I mean, I'm just talking about common sense.
Okay, let me, because, you know, we have a few minutes left, but let me ask you about schools. You've been to schools in Jordan, I think, and
yes.
Egypt.
Yes.
Maybe Egypt, you were very young, but in Jordan.
There's no violence in schools in Jordan. I mean, in the Middle East, very rarely that some individual incidents that happen, but nobody needs to carry a gun.
In a school.
Yeah.
Were there bullying?
In every school in the world, there's bullying, of course, yeah.
So how did you deal with bullying, or if people made fun of other kids?
I was bullied when I was a kid, and I just protected myself. We were, you know, like, kids fight, and then you go to the headmaster or the
principal's office,
and you get, you know, detention and stay after work, after school, I mean. So these things happen everywhere. So, but people don't carry guns. This is not the norm.
Plus, it's not available.
It's not available. I mean, I don't know what's the... I need to be a certain age. Definitely not 18 or 21. I think it's 24, if I'm not mistaken. But you
have to have a reason. You can't just because you're 24 go to any country in the Arab world and say, I need a gun. If you work in the media... But not like in the news, and you are like director of news and you've had a death threat or something, you can apply.
Yeah, to own a gun, you have to apply and you need approval from the officials, which is from the government, from the local government. So it's like anyone can own a gun. But of course, then there's people who buy it, you know, under the table.
So the number one question is why in schools?
Why, and I really can't answer that.
Yeah. I myself don't understand why students need
so
to...
So people who are mentally ill, they just at schools, they're not anywhere else. I mean, it's like, why do these shootings just happen in schools? This is so sad. I mean, this is just...
I think because it's available because, you know, you're young, you have so many hormones working and you're mad or angry or anything, or you had a fight.
But again, there were shootings by people who were under 18, so they have access to these guns as well. So
not all
the shooters were 18 or 19, so they were legally able to buy the guns. So there must be a way that they have access also to guns, which is scary.
Yeah, that's a huge debate. I personally believe
that the students are the ones who are going to change the law today.
What do you think of these young people?
It's just amazing. I mean, one of them said, like, don't underestimate us because next year I'll be able to buy a gun. So it's like, they're not kids. They're very smart, very well informed. They know the law. They know the constitution. They're doing a great job. And I think because politics is not involved in their lives, or they're not affected by politics and money and corporate money, So, because sincerely, they're afraid of what's going on in the country.
You're a media expert. Social media experts, are people in the Arab world, like on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and God knows what else, these things are. I just know these three. Are they following them the way, for instance, I remember, like when I went to the Arab world, people were following the Occupy Wall Street movement. But are they following? Is the Arab world following?
Yes.
What is going on, or it didn't catch?
No, it did catch, of course, because it's repetitive. It's happening every week, every day in America, so it's not normal. But it will be dangerous if people think this is the norm.
But I meant, are people on social media following what these young Americans are doing?
Yes, they are, because it's all over, you know, Twitter and Facebook. So people do watch what's happening in the U.S.
And these people went from like having 3,000 people following it to 170,000. But also with fame came death threats and conspiracy theories. I'm sure, yes.
But the other side, I mean, everybody can express themselves, whether you are with purchasing, owning a gun, or with reforming the whole gun.
But you don't see yourself owning a gun or going to a shooting range. I've always wanted to see if I can.
Never.
See. Never.
Never.
Oh my gosh!
No,
I wanted to do it, but I'm always afraid because
you're in the right place, in
my tennis elbow. Because I thought, you know, the minute I try to fire, you know, in a legal, I'm gonna lose my elbow. But
the idea of just owning a gun to protect yourself, I mean, if you're a hunter or it's part of, you know, a hobby that you have, just like people who, you know, collect trains, old trains and stuff like that. I mean, they collect guns. Okay, that's fine. But I mean, at the end, I mean, you're a sensible person, mature, hopefully not mentally ill. So there must be more rules and regulations, in my opinion, of course, in my personal opinion.
So what do you think of the idea of arming teachers? Think of your teachers in Jordan, for instance, when you were going to school. You want them to be armed?
I'm sure my parents won't send me to school if anybody was armed inside the school. It's just nonsense, because, I mean, what, you're going to create a war zone now in the... And we already have the one in Florida. The officer ran away, so that's...
Or at least didn't do his job. So I know we're running out of time, but did you have security in school when you went?
Never. Even today, nothing.
No, policemen, but
nobody checks anything. The only thing is, like, you should not have a cell phone inside the classroom because that's not prohibited.
Just no cell phone.
Yes.
But...
I mean, not in my days there were cell phones, but yeah, I see my friends' kids that they're not allowed...
To have
cell phones, of course, in the classroom. That's prohibited.
But no security guard or armed.
Nothing.
The first time I went to give a lecture at a high school in where I live, I was petrified when I saw two police officers. I thought they're coming to arrest me or what.
Yeah.
But then, no, it's just, they're just walking. But anyways, I want to wrap it up, Ali. And I need to thank our listeners and remind them that this is 88.5 FM and NPR News is coming.